You're listening to Well Made, a podcast presented by Lumi about the intersection of business and design. Today we're talking to Kevin Kelly. This is a man who's made a career out of talking about the future. But unlike many other people who've tried to do that, Kevin actually has a pretty good track record with his predictions. He's probably most famous for being the founding editor of Wired magazine. He's also written several books, including Out of Control, What Technology Wants, and his most recent work, The Inevitable. You will probably notice from this conversation that I'm a huge fan of his work. It is a fast-paced conversation. We cover a lot of ground. Ready or not, put your goggles on. We're about to jump into the deep end. All right. Well, welcome, Kevin Kelly. How are you doing?
It's really great to be here. Thanks for having me on.
Where are you right now?
I'm in Pacifica, California, which is just the first town on the coast south of San Francisco. We're a big surfer's beach here. And currently it is overcast and foggy, as it usually is in July. The hotter the Central Valley in California gets, the cooler we are. We live in the air conditioning of California, so it's nice and cool, probably around 18 degrees centigrade. And and where are you?
I'm in Los Angeles right now, where it's quite sunny. It's not too bad yet. It was in the high 40s Celsius a couple weeks ago, which was very hot, too hot.
Yeah, it's too hot for me.
But I have been devouring your new book, The Inevitable. Mm-hmm. It's just, I'm a big sci-fi geek. And so I love any book that talks about the future in any capacity. And I think one of the things that always bugs me, especially in the world of movies, because it's more noticeable in movies, one thing that is very hard to get right is, if this idea is true, what else is true about the world?
Right, right. You're exactly right.
And I think that the format of your book is really smart in that it talks about, you know, these 12 forces. And so you can start to imagine scenarios where, what if AI is a really big thing, but also VR or some other thing? And that is a challenge. So can you share a little bit about the structure of the book and how you thought about that?
Yeah. So the book, The Inevitable, is talking about these long-term leanings in technology that tend to move it in a certain direction, in the way that if rain fell on a valley, the path of the drop of water as it went into the river at the bottom of the valley would be unpredictable and completely chaotic. But the direction was inevitable, which was down. And so that kind of a gravity is what I'm looking for, this kind of a force is pulling it in certain directions at the higher general level, while the specifics, the particulars, are completely unpredictable and actually up to our choosing. And so these general tendencies that are baked into the very nature of the technology, and it can be seen, I think, when we're not trying to dictate what happens, when it's unsupervised. And so I was taking these trends, which I categorized as verbs, because to emphasize this idea that where we're headed to is mostly about processes and movements rather than fixed nouns or products. And all these verbs are all feeding each other. So the flowing and the sharing, you know, the more sharing there is, the more flowing there has to be. The more flowing there is, the more sharing. And so these trends are all intermingling and feeding and codependent on each other. I think if I had rewrite the book again, I rewrote a number of times, but if I had to rewrite again, I would emphasize that interplay between the forces even more. But you're right, that is something that I was cognizant of, that when I'm writing it was that you can easier make a scenario of a world in which all these things are taking place. That does become a much richer world. They're feeding each other. They're codependent on each other. And I was conscious of that structure in the book.
Yeah. One thing that started to make more sense to me as I was reading it is the cognifying one. I like the way that word is structured, because I almost think, And I think it'd be helpful for the listeners to go into what some of these words mean, but you have chapters titled Becoming, Flowing, Screening, Accessing. But I started to think of them more as becomeifying, if that makes sense, flowifying, screenifying, accessifying, because it's like the process of that thing beginning to emerge all over the place in everything that we do. Yeah.
No, that's a really great point. I wish I'd thought of that. Maybe I would have emphasized it. But cognifying, which is, I think, the second or third chapter, it is an English word that does exist. I think it's pretty Latin. I use it to mean to make smarter, because there's no verb in English that means to make smarter. And we don't say smartifying or smarting or something, and none of those really work. But I'm using the word cognifying to mean to make smarter. And that's the general task or a job that we're doing these days, is we're making just about everything smarter by plugging it into an AI that will be a commodity, like electricity, something you just get on the cloud. And so the AI is flowing into things. It goes back to this idea of flowing. And I do think you could say the same thing, that, you know, that there's a filterifying and there's accessifying, and that the nouns become verbs, nouns become processes. And that's sort of what that is also showing, that things that we think of as solid and dependable are actually at the root a process, a verb, a flow, something that's mutating, something that's becoming. So they're all kind of related like that.
Let's get a little more specific just so people can understand. Actually, the accessifying, as I'll call it, chapter of your book was one of my favorite ones. Can you describe a little bit about what that trend means?
General drift is that most of the things that we have and use in our daily life, while they're hard and physical, we could best think of them as a process that's always being upgraded, and that we kind of are touching a momentary ephemeral state of something that's changing. And that if you can actually then take that kind of process or service, even if it's a physical thing, and you can distribute it so that it becomes available to anybody instantly, anywhere in the world, like you can with a digital file, say, of music. So music, which was used to be on vinyl records, is now some bits, and those bits can be sent anywhere to anyone. And so at any time, night or day, anywhere you are, you can access that music file because of technology and the way it can flow. And so if you can access something anywhere, anytime, then you don't need to own it.
Right.
In fact, ownership becomes much of a burden, because you have to back it up, upgrade it, catalog it, maintain it, secure it, all these other things, and it becomes a bit of a burden.
Yeah. I talk about this all the time with the idea of self-driving cars, because, you know, Uber is going in that sort of direction generally, because you don't have to own a car. It becomes more and more accessible to you to just jump in a car that's moving next to you. But back in the 50s, let's say, like, the car was the symbol of freedom for teenagers growing up around that time. But teenagers growing up now would probably see it as a burden and would see Uber as a sort of freedom, right?
Exactly right. So if you can summon a car anytime, anywhere, and it's there fairly instantly, and then it leaves, you know, disposes of itself when it's done, that is much superior to owning it. And so just as we've done with Uber, we can do with other physical things, not just the digital things. If you can facilitate their arrival and their disappearance, and then you have, you know, people maintaining them. So there are some people who own some things, but generally the general default stance is that you don't own things, you access things. 50 years ago, if you said, well, you know, accessing, maybe you could understand it for digital things, but not real things like cars, it just shows you that if you have sufficient and appropriate technology, that will happen. And particularly if you have these auto-driven cars, which doesn't matter how long it takes them to find parking spaces and whatnot. And what are we going to do once we're inside these cars? Well, we're going to do VR. You know, we're going to be working with screens. This is why some people think that Apple actually might become a car company, because inside the car, you'll be spending most of your time,
right,
the auto-driven car, you know, doing all the things you would do with Apple products. And so you'd be completely suited and fit to you. You'd step in it and recognize who you are. It'd give you your screen design, whatever it is. You would continue wherever you were the last time you were in the car or in your office. And so that idea of moving away from ownership, which is the foundation of capitalism, so going to accessing is a huge disruption. And then trying to imagine all the things that seem improbable right now, to access and not own, like clothing.
Yeah.
But in fact, there's a huge rental.
Rent the Runway is a great example.
Handbags, all kinds of stuff, or 3D print them.
Yeah.
In a local area. So there's all kinds of new technologies coming along that will accelerate this general movement away from owning them and making them flow more like bits. As we know, bits are really hard to own. No one really owns bits. The idea of ownership of bits is really problematic. It has been. It was the whole, you know, foundation of the disruption by music, because if I own something and make a copy of it, do I also own the copy, or do you own a copy? So the ownership was really problematic with bits. And so if we can make things flow like bits, that also disrupts their ownership.
It's really weird because technology moves that way in like a very slow pace, and then suddenly it's there. You know, you give a lot of great examples throughout the book of each of the trends, and you know, accessing is one that I think about all the time because we make packaging. So like our kind of idea for Lumi is that we want to help make some of the infrastructure that moves the physical things around from one person to another. But I think people will be familiar with Spotify and Uber and Airbnb. And so then you challenge them to think about what else could be turned into a service or a subscription. You point out furniture, and I was like, furniture, that's a weird one. Is there a bed that could come into my apartment and then go away? That was a really interesting one, and I think there's so many of those. Yeah.
Here's where I would go with that. If you think about camping gear,
sure, it
gets better every year. And so rather than, you know, clean and maintain everything, you're always getting the state-of-the-art camping gear. Well, chairs, office chairs in particular, are actually fairly high tech. Mm. And they could be improving fast enough where you actually wanted to upgrade every 2 years, say. Anywhere you would see lots of upgrades, or upgrades would be important, that's where subscribing is better than owning.
Right. There is a page on Wikipedia that I, for some reason, I go to all the time, and it is a list of the oldest companies in the world. And there are many that have been around for 200 or 300 years, and most of them, I've found out, make beer and wine. But there are also a lot of them that make all kinds of random things, like pickles and bells, just random things that people need. And I guess my question is, if you're an entrepreneur, how do you deal with the overwhelming nature of how fast things are changing right now? And if you, does it matter to try and build something that lasts? Like,
so I actually like Jeff Bezos's long. He's repeated this many times, but I think it's really true.
What's not going to change?
Yeah, right. He says he builds his business on what's not going to change.
Right.
Which is like, people want more selection and cheaper prices forever. They'll always want that. But there was another Good to Great by, I can't remember his name, who looked at, and they did a comparative study with analytics and a lot of data, at the differences between good companies and the great ones. And the great ones were the ones that, you know, like you're identifying as having been around not just forever, but had a really high recognition and brand awareness and, you know, good vibes. And what they found out was that the difference was that often the businesses at some of these long-term companies changed over time, like Nokia, which right. began originally as, I think it was a lumber company in Finland.
They made rubber galoshes. Yeah.
And then maybe they transitioned into timber.
Yeah, I think so. It's crazy. Nintendo is also like that. Nintendo started in the late 1800s and used to make playing cards.
Yeah. I think that what endured was the was a core set of values and a core set of abstract principles, you know, a mission. And that the business that they were in actually wavered and changed over time. And so I mean, that's another, I mean, besides like selling something that people always want, which is alcohol, you could also just have a really great enduring business by maintaining a certain set of values, and the business that you're in would constantly, in their terms today, would pivot. And so what I'm guessing is, if we went into the future and there was, you know, companies like Google was still around, or Apple or other ones that we don't know, I would bet that they're still not making the same thing that they made. I've been predicting that Google by 2025, I'm trying to remember what the data is, would basically, their major revenue would be coming from selling AI. And so they no longer be an advertising-based company. They would be an AI company. That to me is a plausible shift, but who knows if it really happens. it's kind of like a person. It's like these days, the skills you have are going to constantly change. Your entire occupation will probably disappear. It's very rare that people stay in even in the same industry. What they're acquiring is kind of, you know, the meta skills and values and attitudes, which is what people are hiring them for, because the skills are going to be learned on the job, on demand. You're constant newbies. We're always having to learn and unlearn stuff. And so I think companies are going to be the same kind of thing. There's a meta skill level for the company and the actual industry or products they may, you know, navigate into from one industry to another. I find that very, very plausible.
So what are those principles and meta skills that you really have to build into your company to make it lasting in any capacity?
Well, I mean, there's the obvious one of constantly learning, but there is one that is counterintuitive, and it has to do with companies that are particularly successful. It doesn't really apply to startups, but it kind of does. And that is that as companies, like say an Amazon or even a Google, as they become more successful, and as the culture of excellence, you know, the Tom Peters kind of excellence, where excellence is not in someone's department, it's just embedded into the very fabric of the company. In my terminology of the way the biologists talk about a landscape, and they have fitness excellence as a hill. So you're climbing a hill, and it's also a computer science thing, hill climbing. So hill climbing means that you're ascending to greater perfection, greater fitness, greater success as you go up the hill. And you have the entire company, from the secretaries to the VPs to the janitor, to do whatever they're doing to do it excellently. And the problem is that when you get to the top, you're at the peak, but whatever it is that you're doing may be dwarfed by a larger peak that's emerging nearby. It's what they call, you're stuck on a local optima. When there's a global optima in the bigger landscape, there's even a higher peak over there. And so the example would be like you're Olivetti and you're perfecting the typewriter, and everybody in your entire corporation is working towards that excellence. You make the most perfect typewriter, and you've now have the most perfect typewriters in the world. But then there's word processors coming up, which is a huger, bigger, higher mountain. And you're on perfecting the optimal of this typewriter. And so the only way you can get to that larger mountain is by going down. And at that point, it's impossible, because everybody is pushing up. Everybody is working to excellence. And there's nobody who's going to say, let's become less efficient, less excellent. Let's head towards chaos. Let's go down where there's less profit. Let's go where there's more or no higher risk, smaller margins, smaller market. I mean, this is contrary to every single business impulse there is. And the more excellent a company is, the more difficult that becomes. And so in a certain sense, you're asking for the approaches or the attitudes or principles. One of them is going to be maintaining some ability to kind of like go in the completely wrong direction of like, we're going to do something that's stupid in a certain business sense. We're going to do something that is contrary to everything that an accountant would do. We're going to do something that's high risk, low margins, high uncertainty, unproven, dangerous, life-threatening, you know, whatever it is. And it takes kind of a crazy person, you know, like a Steve Jobs or others, to force that, because everything and all the natural instincts of everyone is to go in the other direction.
Yeah. You know, as you were describing this, I was wondering what would we say to the executives at Olivetti if we could go back in time? And I'm not sure what the right answer is, because when you think about companies like Microsoft, for example, they saw things coming to some extent. They knew tablets would be a big thing, and they made a tablet, you know, 10 years too early. They saw that mobile was coming, and they made a smartphone 10 years too early, and then they kind of fizzled out. They weren't at the right place at the right time, so to speak. It's very hard, right?
It's extremely hard. In fact, it is so hard that it's actually easier to start something new than it is to change. This is why startups will forever, in general, as a class, will forever have an advantage over the incumbents, because it is so, so difficult to move the incumbent, which is one of the reasons why I don't worry too much about the natural monopolies of the Microsofts and the Amazons and Googles, because they're only there for a limited time. Now, the thing about the startups, of course, is I'm talking about startups as a class, because individually, the likelihood of any one startup succeeding is like zero, you know, it's 1% or whatever it is. Most startups will fail. So the startups are plagued by the challenge that statistically, whatever they're doing is also going to fail. And that's the problem that the big companies have, is because they try something and fails, like a startup. So you know, only whatever it is, say 5% of them work. So they would have to do this 100 times to get it to work. Startups do it because they're desperate. They have no choice. Big companies want to buy their way out, so they'll try to spend money on it and to purchase their way out. You know, that's like predator prey, the natural balancing of the world. Why the whole world is not just big companies is because they're going to get stuck in their success. And the startups have the advantage that they have nothing to lose, but they have the disadvantage that they're probabilistically going to fail. So the whole thing as an ecosystem works great.
I don't know if that's reassuring. If I'm a person who is just, you know, making jams and selling them at my local farmer's market or something, what happens when, you know, all of your trends occur and I'm just trying to sell my jams or making something that, you know, is a craft of some sort?
Well, so there's several things to say. One is the way VCs today use the word startup, it's a very particular and peculiar right. definition, which is something that was going to scale, that has yeah. growth embedded in it. When most startups in the country and the world are mom and pop enterprises that aren't going to scale into a fortune, but they're going to make a living. So the VCs denigrate that as a you know, lifestyle business. So I think there's a huge future and there's a huge opportunity. A lot of these lifestyle businesses make they're very profitable. They're just not going to scale into take over the world. If you're satisfied with making a living versus making a fortune, there's a lot of room in there. But I think the idea of just making jams is not going to be enough for anybody. I mean, jams are a commodity, so you have to do something special. You're going to have to keep pivoting.
Well, but beer is a commodity, and there's companies that have been making the same beer for 1,000 years, you know?
There's a lot of beer companies that have gone out of business, too.
Yes, that's true. That's very true.
Just making beer alone is not enough, is what right. I'm saying. When you're making a commodity, you're taking the commodity and you're adding X. It's like selling water. How do you sell water, which is free? Well, you tell a story or you have a brand. You're adding something. It's an interface to something that's a commodity. There's all these other ways. And so if you're going to make jams, you have to do something in addition to that, something extra, tell a story, have a, you know, whatever it is that makes it extra. And the beers is the same thing. You know, Pabst, whatever it was a beer that was dying, and then they did some marketing of the right type that appealed to hipsters, and it took off. And so the point is that you don't have to aim for the millions to succeed. And this is my 1,000 true fans theory, which was actually not in the book. And that is that if you are connecting directly with your fans, you're not going through distributors, publishers, broadcasters, or whatever, you're just having direct connection, you can reduce the magnitude of your audience by many factors. And depending on how many there are of you, or if you're a solo, a duet, or a small team, you know, it's like 1,000 times each person in that order of magnitude, you can actually make a living. If you have these true fans and a concentric circle of, you know, of avid fans, not just true fans, but the idea being that if you have direct contact to use this technology, you can work with a much smaller audience. The niche audience works when it's facilitated by technology, which reduces the degree of the challenge that you have to go. You don't need to have a million customers. You don't need to have 100,000. You can have in the tens of thousands. That's going to be adequate to make a living. And if you think of that in those terms, well, then I can do something with making jams. I can do kind of something where I am a producer at a small scale. You know, 1,000, 5,000, 10,000, that's within the range of a family lifestyle business.
Yeah, and I think what's cool about the present and the future is now those 1,000 people can come from literally anywhere in the world. It doesn't have to be your local village that you live in. You can actually, I say that it's like the best time to start something weird, because you can find 1,000 people who like that weird thing that you're into.
Right, you're exactly right. The niche is now drawing from the pool of 7 billion people instead of just your local neighborhood. So they're all just one click away too. I mean, that's the other thing is that even the longest tail, an item on the longest tail is actually just one click away from the bestseller. And so it's very viable to have that kind of thing. But there's several caveats about that theory. There's two. One is that this does not appeal to everybody. Dealing with your clients, your customers, your fans becomes a lot of what you do. And there are many artists and creators who don't want to deal with that. They just want to paint or photograph or dance, whatever it is. They don't want to have to deal with their fans. And that's fine. Then they'll have to have intermediates. And then the second thing is, as I hinted before, you just have to kind of keep multiplying that for the number of people who are actually on your team. So if you have 10 people, then it's going to be 10 times as many. But outside of that, I think it's a really very, very viable option for many people.
Switching gears a little bit, you've been talking about the future for a long time. Why do you do it? People like E.M. Forster wrote this amazing book in like 1906 called The Machine Stops. And it's just incredible, but nobody remembers it. I mean, you know, you remember it and a few other people probably talk about it. But does it matter if you're right? Is that why you're doing it?
No. Well, first of all, I mean, as you might notice, and I'm the first to talk about this, the things I'm talking about in this book are all present already.
Sure.
Marshall McLuhan had this great quote. He said he's always careful to never predict anything unless it was already happening. I'm very likely to be wrong about lots of the stuff because I just don't know what I'm going to be wrong about. But my aim is actually to get people to behave more optimistically, to embrace this stuff. When we embrace it, rather than try and stop it, prohibit it, turn it back, turn it off, outlaw it, we'll overall reap more benefits from it and we'll minimize the harm. What I'm trying to prevent is the natural reaction to be scared of it, to be fearful, to want to turn it off, turn it back, turn it down. You know, the efforts that I see of people trying to outlaw Uber in Austin, you know, it's just like, that's just so counterproductive. The same thing about the music industry, 30-year war on copying. You can't stop the copying. It just, it wants to copy. You have to work with the copying. I don't mean like, you know, like getting rid of copyright. I mean like making copyright work with the copying. You know, don't keep extending it like 70 years into the future. All that kind of stuff is ridiculous. You have to work with it. And so it's the same thing with tracking. Tracking's coming. Tracking's inevitable. What kind of world we have with tracking is not inevitable. Let's try and work with the tracking and surveillance that comes. Same with AI. We had one fatality in AI already. There are going to be many more, but it's nowhere near the million people that humans kill every year. So we're not going to outlaw human drivers. We need to prepare ourselves and rehearse for this. So that's why I'm talking about it coming in and being inevitable. It's not whether I'm right. It's getting people to prepare for this rather than try and freak out and try and stop it.
Yeah, I think the thing that's hard is like the word inevitable sounds kind of ominous, but it's, I think what I love about what you're saying right now is what if we could actually be positive and optimistic and enthusiastic about it? Because, you know, once the genie is out of the bottle kind of thing, it eventually works itself out and people get used to things. There is a transitional period that can be difficult and frustrating and a lot of stuff gets displaced. But what if you looked at it optimistically? What would that look like? Mm-hmm. It seems like it's a better life.
Yeah, no, people behave much better when they're optimistic. Yeah. You know, they think longer term. And that's the main thing is if you believe that there's a future, if we believe they're going to be here for 1,000 years or 500 years, 100 years, then you behave differently. And we will be. If you accept the fact that AI is inevitable, it's going to be everywhere. We're going to work with AIs. They're going to replace a lot of the tasks that we do. And you're not going to say like, well, they're going to take over and kill us. No, they're not. They're going to make more new jobs. They're going to make us richer. They're going to help the poor people everywhere in the world. I mean, if we can do that, then we can avoid all kinds of crazy and stupid stuff that people will want to throw up in the process of it. Having said that, you know, there's going to be conflict and there's going to be people who lose their jobs, like half the truck drivers in the country, which is the most common occupation in America. Rather than like, okay, we're going to outlaw that. Some people are going to be calling for that. We should think about other ways in which we can deal with this fact and transition, train, retrain, educate, rather than say, okay, we won't let AIs drive trucks, which I know some people will start to say. And I think we would make better ancestors, as Jonathan Salk talks about, if we actually embrace these things now.
So sitting next to me, I have this book that's become very meaningful to me, which is The Last Whole Earth Catalog. And I know that you worked on that. It was published before I was born, but somehow I've been really getting back into kind of the ideas that were happening around that time. My edition is from 1971, but I know that you worked editing one in the 80s. Is that correct?
That's correct.
What was your role in that?
The Whole Earth Catalog was a oversized, they call it tabloid, so it's like the size of a newspaper, and it was printed on newsprint, and it was bound together into a book, and it was mailed out, well, initially it was mailed out a couple times a year, and then eventually every couple of years, and it became a really fat book, and even though it was called a catalog, it was catalog only in a kind of conceptual sense, that it was descriptions of different tools and books and a lot of book reviews. Most of the reviews were written by readers, and it didn't really have any advertising. And so one way to think of it was a user-generated web that was printed on newsprint. So it was users who were enthusiastic about sharing something that they would send in to us editors, and we would give it a kind of a binary decision of a yes or no, and then print it with their own voice without very much change at all. Well, actually, we typeset it and printed and took pictures. And it was printed rapidly on really cheap newsprint and sent out. So it was like the closest thing you could do to having the web without having the web. If you read it now, you'll recognize it because there were blog posts. They're basically people blogging on newsprint. And my role was at first as a contributor, and I was contributing stuff about travel because that's what I was doing. And eventually I was hired to edit the publication, the magazine, and then I did some of the catalogs after Stuart Brand, who was the founder, left to write some books. And this oversized catalog had tools in the broadest sense of the word, things that were helpful that you could use. And it's hard for young people today to kind of understand the significance of it. It became a million-plus bestseller, even though it was this oversized thing that bookstores hated because it was hard to shelve, but a lot of it was just sold by mail. And it kind of actually launched a lot of the small publishing that still exists today, because Stuart, in the catalog, he was the founder, told how he made the book, disclosed all the finances of the book and the process in which he made this book, in this kind of do-it-yourself way of buying and renting some really cheap, ingenious equipment so anybody could actually desktop publish way before computers. And it launched kind of the small publishing business, in part because it also reviewed books that were printed by small press. But I was saying that in the early 70s, it was the only place you could find this kind of information, which was mostly kind of utilitarian or practical how-to information. Yeah. If you went into a typical bookstore in 1970, there was almost nothing in the bookstore. It was some bestsellers. There was occasional random little thing. There was no internet. There was no place to go to find stuff out, how to do anything. And the Whole Earth Catalog was the first place to take together all this obscure knowledge of someone who knew how to make lumber from trees with a chainsaw, or to build your own house, or to grow your own food, or to start bees, or to do homeschooling, or anything. And it kind of searched the world, or mostly the English-speaking world, for anything that had this kind of valuable information, and it brought it all together into one place. And it brought it together in kind of a very interesting design on the page. But the idea was, here was this Uber index, this Yahoo, this Google search for how-to information, which was impossible to find any other way. And that was this amazing, marvelous miracle at the time. And now, if you go back to it now, it doesn't have the same impact, because you can just use your phone and search for something and you'll get a YouTube clip that will tell you how to do something. That was like a million miles away when the Whole Earth Catalog came out. Before that, there was no other way to find this information.
I mean, it's amazing how you, as you flip through it from, like you said, you know, how do I do beekeeping to some really trippy article or review about Buckminster Fuller's newest book or something like that, or, you know, what, where should I buy seeds? It's opinionated in a way that I think feels relevant to me today.
Right. You'll recognize the voice because it's the blogger's voice. It's this opinionated, informed enthusiast. Again, that was also completely unknown and completely refreshing in 1970 because, believe me, the New York publications did not talk with that tone at all. It was completely absent. And people who came across it, like myself, were like, oh my gosh, this is like real people talking real language about real things that I had no idea and I really want to know about. And so for those who found it, it was like instant love at first sight. And I saw the first one at Woodstock in 1970, right at the end of high school. I was like, boing, 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 this is mine. This is for me. I am this. And it changed my life. I enjoy nothing more myself than spending a late night looking through the old Holworth catalogs and reading them because it does something to me.
Well, here's what it is. This is what it is. What does it mean to be human? That is the question that I ask myself when I read it. Because, you know, my definition of like a great human being is my grandfather, who I just actually went to visit last weekend. He lives in Santa Barbara. He's 85. And he was a NASA engineer, but also did things like grow his own vegetable garden, you know, went lobster fishing and did these things to kind of like feed his family on a very like primal level. And I love that idea that human beings can be at once very curious about the biggest things in the universe and also have to deal with the practical nature of staying alive and eating and breathing and that kind of stuff. And I think the Whole Earth Catalog asks both of those questions, or like challenges the reader to like explore both of those things.
Wow. Yeah. I haven't felt that, but I see where you could get that. And so for your listeners, by the way, I think there are probably used copies on eBay somewhere. I think the cool tools gives you the more practical aspect. And I didn't try to capture the bigger stories that I think Stuart was doing with the Whole Earth Catalog. If you have a chance, readers, you should seek out like the next Whole Earth Catalog, I think was actually the biggest of them all. That was in 1982, maybe. Take a look at it. I always saw it as a catalog of possibilities of what a human could be. I was like, oh my gosh, I had no idea I could do this. Maybe if I could do that, I could do even this. There's no limit to the possibilities of what I or humans could do.
Tools to me are the most interesting thing to create and to design. I love making tools, creating tools for other people, and cool tools and Whole Earth is a tool for finding tools. And to me, the extension of a tool is like a utility, the pipes, the infrastructure, the things that you don't necessarily even think of as a tool. Like you were talking about AI, for example, as being a utility for the future, like a faucet, you know, there's just like smartness pouring out of it. So I have a fascination with tools because we're just, I think that's what humans are. Like we like to make tools that extend our body and allow us to go places and do things that we aren't naturally capable of.
Yeah, no, I agree that that is the higher art is we're the tool makers and making tools that facilitate, they call them the enabling tools, like the internet, which is a tool that enables all these other things. And I think you're right that I do see AI and some of these others as enabling tools in the future. Mastering those will be the meta skill that will facilitate the making of many other things. You know, people have said for a long time that the biggest, most important invention of Silicon Valley was making the startup system. And I've long said that the only invention that China did not invent before the West was the scientific method. It was the only one they missed, and that was yet the most important one. Because once you have the scientific method, you can accelerate the invention of all these other things that were just done by trial and error. So there are these meta tools that we're involved in, and I think we haven't discovered all of them yet. We're just at the beginning of the beginning, the first hour, and there are no AI experts. There's no VR experts. There's no experts in codification or tracking or even the internet. I think in 20 years, 25 years, 30 years, they'll look back and they'll say, you didn't even have the internet back in 2016. You thought you did, but you didn't really have it. And I think, you know, all this stuff that we're doing right now is still at the beginning. All the experts are ahead. None of us are late. You can start and you can become the AI expert right now if you wanted to. And there'll be a lot of new tool sets invented in the future. That's my hope, is that everybody alive is presented with some tool, some instrument that will help express their genius and share it with others. And that's what I'm working to, is to increase the choices and possibilities in the world for the present generation and future generations, just as I've benefited from the past. And I hope my book, The Inevitable, helps people prepare for this coming abundance, and that we can, again, maximize the benefits and minimize the harm.
Well, thank you very much. And everybody can go get the book on all the places where you get books. They should also check out kk.org, your website, Cool Tools. Where else? Twitter.
Kevin 2 Kelly. Amazon has the Cool Tools book, which there are some copies left. And it's a great gift for a young person. Open up their mind to what's possible.